Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix series Mindhunter. This season, the unit interviews more notorious serial killers and starts to investigate high-profile cases, such as Wichita's BTK. Mindhunter Season 2, now streaming only on Netflix.
And HBO, presenting Game of Thrones. Critics have hailed the final season as TV's greatest show of all time, and era-defining. Nominated for 32 Emmys, including Outstanding Drama Series, the most Emmy nominations of any drama ever.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review the action flick Angel Has Fallen, starring Gerard Butler and Morgan Freeman. Brittany Runs a Marathon, a comedic drama, stars Gillian Bell. And we'll hear about the documentary which tells the origin story behind the Broadway musical Fiddler on the Roof. It's Fiddler, a miracle of miracles. Film Week on KPCC.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix series Mindhunter. Inspired by events recounted in former FBI agent John Douglas' book, Mindhunter, Inside the FBI's Elite Serial Crime Unit. This season, the unit interviews more notorious serial killers and starts to investigate high-profile cases, such as Wichita, Kansas' BTK, and an emerging serial killer in Atlanta. Directed by David Fincher, Andrew Dominik, and Carl Franklin. Mindhunter Season 2, now streaming only on Netflix.
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Such a pleasure to have you with us. This week, our critics are Claudia Puig, who's president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, organization of which all our Film Week critics are members. Leah Lowenstein, a KPCC Film Week critic as well. And we begin with the action flick Angel Has Fallen. Gerard Butler, Morgan Freeman, Piper Perabo star in the film, which is directed and co-written by Rick Roman Waugh. What did you think, Leah?
Well, I actually thought this was better than I think Claudia did. This is the
good
sequel.
We're starting with you then.
Yeah. This is the sequel to the predecessor, Olympus Has Fallen, in which Gerard Butler played Mike Banning, disgraced Secret Service agent who has to fight off terrorists and rescue Morgan Freeman, the president. Who else? But Morgan Freeman.
If not the president, God.
God, exactly.
Yes, that's
or the all-knowing narrator. In this case, Mike Banning himself is the angel, and he has he's gotten implicated in a terrorist plot. We don't know too much about how this happens, but it's extremely harrowing to watch. It's a scene in which drones are unleashed at an alarming rate, and the president, who is fishing, is just barely gotten out alive by Mike Banning, but 18 Secret Service agents have been killed, and Jada Pinkett Smith is the FBI agent who's on the case. It's quite dynamic. I didn't think much of Butler. He did sort of look a little shopworn, and I guess that was the character. He's supposed to be kind of strung out on opioids and back pain, but I particularly was impressed with the way the editing, the shooting, and the cutting, the putting together of the film resembled what is essentially the obsession of my teenage son, Fortnite, and many kids now. It really felt and looked like a video game. You get a lot of POV of the sniper point of view and the victim who's, you know, out trying to outsmart the sniper. So I thought that was kind of an interesting twist.
But would your son want to go see it? I mean,
yes.
Really?
He already does. He liked Olympus Has Fallen, and he's primed to go see this one. And when I told him it reminded me of Fortnite, he was even more excited.
Angel Has Fallen's the film, Claudia?
Well, I didn't like it as much. I feel like the franchise has fallen, and it can't get up.
And it's only two film franchises.
Yeah, you remember there was another trilogy. Film the exact same time, around the same time, called White House Down. We get typically two films around the same time. This was the better of the two,
yes.
I'm pretty sure.
Yes. I mean, and then you go back to sort of the whole president, guarding the president, like In the Line of Fire with Clint Eastwood, which is really good.
Yeah, that was a good one.
This feels like a string of cliches stitched together. Gerard Butler does look worse for wear. And he, you know, the idea of like, so Danny Houston plays that without giving too much away. He's kind of underused. He's such a good, he's a good villain.
Excellent actor.
Yeah, he's a wonderful actor. And you see the two of them like fending off all these much younger people and drones and all stuff. And you're like, these two 50-ish men, you know, it's sort of like that Liam Neeson thing. I find that hard to suspend my disbelief.
It was hard to suspend one's disbelief. But can we say one word or two about Nick Nolte?
Oh, Nick Nolte was the best thing about the movie.
Absolutely.
As far as I was concerned. He looks totally like he looked like in his mugshot. You know that?
He's I don't know if we should say he's an important character from Gerard Butler's past. who comes along in a surprising way. And
he's like a Unabomber, basically. He's out in the middle of nowhere off the grid.
He's like a Ted Kaczynski. He lives in the cabin in the woods. And he injects so much life and so much. There's that twinkle in his eyes.
Those are my favorite scenes. He was everything.
Yeah, and even if you should stay past the initial credit sequence, because there's a really funny little bit as well.
Absolutely.
He was, I think, the best thing about the movie.
He was, and I did like Morgan Freeman. I think he replaced Aaron Eckhart, who had once been the president in one of the other earlier movies, although he was comatose through most of it. But even when he's comatose, he has this gravitas and dignity that he brings to the role of a president, which we don't see a whole lot
of
these days.
And then he whenever he does speak, he speaks in these beautiful,
Stentorian
paragraphs.
Yeah. And I did like the killer drone scene. I mean, that was really kind of cool, you know, when they all came in and they're on the water. But I just felt like the whole thing was all about car chases and gun battles and explosions. The person who directed it, I think, was a former stunt man. I felt like there were no surprises. They gave away who the bad guy was pretty early, and it was just... I didn't feel like there was a lot of suspense.
Okay, I agree with you. But given like unity of time, unity of place, and the fact that it managed to keep the action going, I was not bored.
I wasn't bored.
There
was
a high body count, much higher than I wish there was. And given our current context, I wish that there hadn't been quite so much gun violence.
Yeah.
But I thought it held my interest.
Angel Has Fallen, the action film starring Gerard Butler and Morgan Freeman, Rick Roman Waugh, the director and co-screenwriter. It's rated R in wide release. Brittany Runs a Marathon, an action comedy directed by Paul Downs Colazo. It's about a hard-partying woman who takes up running with the goal of competing in the New York City Marathon. Here, Brittany talks with her doctor.
I had a friend. She was prescribed Adderall, and now she's very alert.
You know, some people abuse Adderall.
What?
Let's get you healthy.
I want you to try losing 55 pounds.
That's the weight of a Siberian Husky. You want me to pull a medium-sized working dog off of my body?
Gillian Bell stars in Brittany Runs a Marathon, which is written and directed by Paul Downs Colazo. What'd you think, Claudia?
I'm really glad to see Gillian Bell get her own movie. She's been a supporting character in 22 Jump Street and Workaholics and other films, and she deservedly gets a starring role. She's funny. I thought the supporting cast was great. There was an actor named Utkarsh Ambudkar, who is kind of a love interest in it, who I think was wonderful and charming. You see Lorel Howery, who you remember from Get Out. He's really good in it. You kind of wish they'd had more of the story.
Yeah, Lorel is always
he's always great. Yeah, he plays kind of a father figure to her, which is a really interesting role. I thought this generally worked, and it was likable. It was pleasant. It was funny for the most part. It wasn't that inventive or fresh, and it sometimes bordered on cliche, like, you know, overweight girl loses all this weight and suddenly her life turns around. I kind of wish it had focused more just on her running the marathon and having that be the goal instead of like she runs a marathon and suddenly everything turns around for her. So that felt a little bit like we've seen, you know, versions of that movie. But I liked the chemistry that she had with Ambudkar and Lorel Howery. I generally thought it worked. I just wish it had been maybe less bordering on sort of the fat girl cliches and some of those things that it tried not to. It tried to kind of steer away from that a little bit, but I think it didn't always succeed. So I had mixed feelings, but I generally liked it.
I agree with you that there were times that I felt it did fall back on certain cliches, and you know, but there's cliches are there for a reason, I guess, because they're so effective.
I mean, it shows her on the scale constantly and admiring herself in the mirror. It's like we could have done with one of that, you know, one or two instead of like six of those.
But given that she does start at north of 200 pounds and she's never run even a block, it's sort of, you know, her
inspiration.
Inspirational. Yeah. And I confess I did go get my box of weights my afterward. And
then I did that thing RBG when she was working out.
Then I put my weights down and looked at them while I was watching the rest of the movie. But I think it was a lovely sort of upbeat, inspirational, female empowerment. Yes, you're right. Like, you know, it didn't really need to be so much about the physical, but there is an interior transformation in her as well. And I thought it sort of made a good point for anyone who's at a crossroads in their life or who has sort of come on hard times that if you do something, you know, whatever it is, you're going to start meeting people, you're going to start having experiences that will lead to other things. And she does. She's been unemployed for some time. She does eventually land a job, which eventually leads to a romance. So it's, you know, it's not just the physical transformation.
She actually had a job. She had kind of a dead end job. And I hear that the original person that this was patterned after, which was the writer-director's friend.
Brittany.
Based on
a true story. Yes. She actually had a good job. She was not a ticker taker. She was like the managing director of a theater company. So they made some, you know, modifications. And I kind of wish that they had kept, she had a good job, but this was one area in her life that she couldn't quite manage without making it kind of like a wholesale change. But I get why they did that. It made it a more inspirational story. Overall, I think it worked fine. It's funny because the whole idea of the marathon, I mean, she never looks happy when she's running. She looks like she's really struggling. But
Do people look happy when they run?
I don't know. I've never run a marathon.
And if you did, you wouldn't be looking at what they look like.
That's right.
Brittany Runs a Marathon, comedic drama starring Jillian Bell, Paul Downs Colezo, the writer-director. It's rated R, and you can see it at the Landmark in West L.A. or the Arclight Hollywood. A documentary on the origins of the Broadway musical Fiddler on the Roof, directed by Max Lukowicz. The film called Fiddler, A Miracle of Miracles. Lael?
This is an absolutely delightful and surprisingly illuminating documentary about Fiddler on the Roof. I had seen it many, many, many years ago, and of course, also seen the movie, but hadn't really thought about the tremendous implications of it, both in the theatrical community, culturally, and around the world. This film makes the point that it ends up with the epilogue that every single day since it was first produced in 1964, Fiddler on the Roof has been produced somewhere
around the world. Yeah.
Right. And it is incredibly thorough. I mean, there are interviews with everyone from Topol, the actor, the iconic actor who played Tevye in the film, to the actresses, to Lin-Manuel Miranda, of course, who performed a number from it at his wedding reception.
The Chaim to life.
Yes. And it just, like, it goes incredibly deep. And I thought one of the most touching moments of the film for me was actually when Harvey Fierstein is talking about how, and I never thought about this, how depending on what age you are, when you see Fiddler on the Roof, it has different ramifications and different meaning for you. That when you're a young person, you see it and you identify with the girls and you're sort of wanting to leave home and you're kind of trying to find your own path. And then when you see it as a parent, you really identify much more with the parents in the film and you're trying to hold your family together and retain the tradition. And then when you see it even older, you know, it has even deeper resonance. And it made me want to go see Fiddler on the Roof.
I miss the days when Harvey was in seemingly every documentary.
He's always
such a welcome. He always has interesting observations.
He definitely does. And the thing that they pointed out too about like the iconic song, almost every song in the musical is iconic, but Sunrise Sunset, is that it's sung from a parent's perspective. Mm-hmm. And in so many plays and so many works, everything's done from the young person's perspective. And so, yeah, and the whole family aspect, I think that's what makes it so universal. Mm-hmm. You had, you know, performances going on in Thailand, in Tokyo, in the Netherlands, in Spain, and everybody said, this feels like our story. This is our story.
So there's footage from many of these performances all over the world.
In different languages, and they do a beautiful kind of melange of you know, all the songs being sung in different languages. And I really liked, it made me totally want to go see it again. And it's funny because I remember liking the movie, and I don't know that I've ever seen a musical live. Maybe I have, but it definitely made me want to go out and see it again. And yeah. I thought Topol also had some really poignant memories about it. He's in great shape. He's Topol in his late 80s.
Yeah, he must have been pretty young when he was
played Hevia. Oh, and he had a really funny anecdote about how he just had this terrible tooth operation. Yeah. And so when he was doing that very famous If I Were a Rich Man, and he's singing, you know, he does that little dance, and he's like, that he was actually crying out of pain. Yeah, from his tooth. There were just these great stories. And as you pointed out, Lael, just really wonderful observations from a wide range of people, and kind of putting it in a cultural context. They talk about, you know, it was the same year as The Moonwalk, I guess. Mm-hmm. It came out in 69, or maybe 64. Yeah, the movie. And I just felt like it's also really sadly relevant when you think of, you know, where we are with anti-Semitism right mm-hmm. now, and displaced people and ethnic cleansing and refugees. I just felt like it was a really enlightening documentary.
It's too bad we lost Theodore Bekele, who also was Topol on stage.
Right. And Zero Mostel. Yeah.
Yeah. And Bekele, I think he died about 4 years ago. Great actor. Right. And I think he started as a teenager in the role. And
wow.
I assume they, you know, they had
aged him up. Yeah.
But
the
then
beard
he continued
helps.
Playing the role for, you know, the rest of his life, essentially. So,
right.
Yeah. Just, I'm sure there's so many great stories. And I think it's in the doc, they say, one early review said there were no memorable songs. In the
oh, my gosh. Well, and I thought it was really interesting for the movie. They, you know, obviously.
That was a Variety review.
Oh, really? Oops. A person is not working anymore. Norman Jewison was the director. And it was funny because they all thought that, given his name, that he was Jewish, but he's a goy. And he talks about that, which I thought was really interesting as well.
Fiddler, A Miracle of Miracles, tells the backstory on the creation of Broadway's Fiddler on the Roof. Max Lukowitz is the director. It's rated PG-13 and in selected theaters. We have many more reviews to come up. We'll also talk about the future of what we call art house cinema. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Back in just 1 minute.
KPCC podcasts are supported by HBO, presenting Sharp Objects, based on the best-selling novel by Gillian Flynn. The story focuses on Camille Preaker, a journalist with a history of psychiatric issues, who returns to her rural hometown to cover the apparent murders of two preteen girls. The limited series was hailed by critics as exquisite, hauntingly compelling, and a true masterpiece. Nominated for 8 Emmys, including Outstanding Limited Series. Visit hbo.com/FYC for more on Sharp Objects.
We so appreciate your being with us on Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by film critics Lael Lowenstein and Claudia Puig. Many more reviews to go, including the Mexican horror fantasy film Tigers Are Not Afraid. Isa Lopez, the writer-director, Paula Lara stars, along with Juan Ramon Lopez. What'd you think, Claudia?
I really like this film. It's very much in the vein of Pan's Labyrinth. You can see where she was influenced by Guillermo del Toro. It has that almost the same duality from Pan's Labyrinth, where there's this gritty reality of the, in that case, it was a war. And then there's a fantasy interwoven, a fairy tale. And it's this is set against the drug war in Mexico and narco trafficking in this town that has almost become like a ghost town. And it starts off by telling you that since the drug war began there in 2006, 160,000 people have been killed, 53,000 have disappeared, and entire areas and cities have become ghost towns. And what they are focusing on is that no one knows how many children of the dead and missing are left behind. So you come across these five kids who are essentially living on their own in little kind of makeshift encampments because their parents have either been killed or taken away in some way. And so it's a very serious subject. And it conveys the sense of destruction that's come with all the narco trafficking. But it also has this really beautiful fantasy element that's woven throughout. And I was really glad to see a movie about this subject made by a native Mexican director, rather than Americans making the exploitative movies that play on people's fears and xenophobia, like Sicario and some of those films. This, you know, this feels much more Like it's taking a, it's much more perceptive and sensitive, and it's beautifully made. It's powerful. It is dark, but it has this these magical realism elements that are interwoven that are just beautiful.
Well, and the other thing I was going to say about the director is you know, we've talked about many times on the program, so important that the next generation of Mexican filmmakers be cultivated, that their strong work be seen. And,
right.
You know, we
and
have,
women
course,
directors all the more.
Yeah, we have the three highly influential
the three
guys
amigos
who've been with
that
us
they say.
For
yes,
decades
yes,
now.
Who are wonderful.
Yeah.
And what I also, the next step I'd really like to see is more American Latino directors, because we don't, we have so few. I mean, but there's some wonderful directors coming out of Mexico. And so, and Lila Aviles, who did The Chambermaid, and now this film with Isa Lopez. I just thought it was terrific. And the lead actress, Paola Laura, is terrific. And the orphan kids, there were some that are really young, and they're just so, you know, you just, your heart breaks for them.
Tigers are not afraid. Lael.
I completely concur with Claudia. It was beautiful and harrowing, tough to watch, but it had this great kind of sense of energy and this kind of fable, this fabulous quality to it that that made it not, it didn't feel like exploitative of the children, even though the kids in the film are clearly playing kids who are being exploited.
They're imperiled.
Yes, but they, it felt, there was this kind of beautiful authenticity to it and tremendous confidence on the part of the young actors, which I think speaks to Isa Lopez's directing ability.
Absolutely.
Because they seemed utterly like to inhabit their roles.
They seem so natural. She really knows how to direct children, which has got to be difficult to do.
Yeah.
Tigers Are Not Afraid. Isa Lopez, the writer, director. The film is in Spanish, Mexican movie that's unrated. And you can see it at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica, Lemley's NoHo North Hollywood, the Playhouse Lemley in Pasadena, and the Alamo Drafthouse Cinema downtown L.A. And John Horn of The Frame interviewed the writer, director, Isa Lopez. You can hear his conversation with her from the link on our Film Week page at KPECC.org. The documentary Jawline takes a look at teenagers who build up fan bases on social media. Liza Mandelup is the director of the documentary. Lael?
So this film is also scary, but in a different way. Austin Tester is a 16-year-old from rural Tennessee who has a Justin Bieber haircut back in the early days, young Justin Bieber, and is cultivating his legions of teenage girl fans, mostly online. So he's a YouTuber. He's got his own channel. He's got his Instagram. He is a social media influencer. And his message is one of inspiration and, you know, love yourself and
positivity,
which is ironic given that his life itself is, you know, not so good. He had an abusive alcoholic father who abandoned the family. His home life is not great. And
he talks about being poor a lot.
And also fame as being a way out for him, that he feels like eventually he's going to, you know, make money and he's going
to. It's like how people used to go to Hollywood to be
exactly.
A star.
Exactly. Now they just go in their bedroom.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And he talks about, you know, wanting to go to L.A. because that's where it all happens. And in fact, there's several social media conferences that he goes to, and I don't know, he makes appearances
yeah.
and gets mobbed by these fans, and it's really, for our generation, it looks like Beatlemania or something. It's kind of crazy. He's contrasted with Michael Wiest, who's a manager in LA who's got his own, you know, sort of boy band of teen social media stars who he manages very tightly and kind of controls where they go and what they do. And there's a couple of overlapping scenes where they come together and you're sort of contrasting the different techniques. It was scary to me just because I thought, you know, wow, the young people are so easily swayed by this. It's such a powerful tool. It can be used for good or certainly the opposite.
It's pretty scary in that. And it's interesting because I feel like in some ways he's conflicted, but he doesn't necessarily know it. Like, you know, he's 16. He talks about wanting to be famous, and that's a way out of this little horrible town. But he has nightmares of girls chasing after him. Yeah. And yet when he sees girls screaming for some of the other ones who are more popular, screaming like they would for like K-pop stars or One Direction, he murmurs longingly, you know, that'd be nice to have that. All those people look up to them. Dang, you know. And
yeah, he craves the followers.
He craves it. And, and then on the other hand, I like that the director, Liza Mandelup, was kind of empathetic and compassionate about this. She wasn't, you know, you could easily have done this film in a very
judgmental
and just, you know, cynical way. And she doesn't. I mean, these young girls, some of them have been bullied. Some of them have cut themselves. The girls who turn to these boys, and he does give them messages. He says, you're beautiful, you're smart. And he listens to them. Yeah. And they do seem like they, you know, it made me really sad about the lives of young kids.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of them have come from very troubled families, or they've been bullied, or you realize how many kids suffer from that, and they're looking for whatever they can as a panacea. And you know, I thought he was like a well-meaning kid, but at the same time, it was disturbing and depressing.
Yeah.
Jawline, the documentary. Liza Mandelup is the director. You can see it at Lemley's Playhouse Pasadena, as well as on the streaming service Hulu. It's unrated. And John Horn of The Frame interviewed the director, Liza Mandelup. You can hear his conversation with her on our link, the Film Week page, kpecc.org. The Mexican drama, This Is Not Berlin, goes back to Mexico City, 1986. Hari Sama is the director and co-screenwriter. Claudia.
This is a good week for Mexican films. Hari Sama's film is a kind of a clash of sex, drugs, and punk rock. And also about coming of age and self-discovery. It really conjures up an era in mid-1980s Mexico City, seen through the eyes of this sensitive 17-year-old. It's a coming-of-age film, but it's also a portrait of like this punk scene and performance art and all the stuff that was going on. And so it's both edgy and sensitive. And it explores kind of the cultural shifts that are going on in Mexico City right after the earthquake of 1985. And yet at the same time, it also follows this young guy's personal awakening against this backdrop of this club. I think it was called the Azteca. And, you know, we see so many coming of age movies. It's such a common trope. But this is kind of a portrait of an era as well, which adds a little bit more heft, I think, to it. And of this underground culture in Mexico City that I think a lot of people probably didn't know about. And anybody who, you know, you'll recognize the music, a lot of, you know, new wave punk music, Joy Division. And then the art scene that was kind of meshed with that performance art. And the lead actor is quite good, is Zabiani Ponce de Leon. I don't know if he's related to the explorer way back when. But he's actually all the young actors are really good. And I'm not sure. I looked him up to see what he'd done before, and I didn't see that he'd done anything before. So
could be a debut.
It could be a debut. Yeah, so it celebrates this era and sort of the thrill of growing up and performance art and, you know, the rush of drug trips for these kids. And you kind of get a feeling that something is going to happen that could lead everything kind of take everything off on a dark path, but it doesn't necessarily go there, which is nice. It doesn't go in the directions you necessarily expect.
We're talking about the Mexican drama This Is Not Berlin, in Spanish, of course.
And I forgot Marina de Tavira from Roma. Is it?
Ah, very good. All right. Zabiani Ponce de Leon is the star of the film. Hari Sama is the director and co-screenwriter. It's unrated, and you can see it at the New Art Theater in West L.A. Hot Air, a drama directed by Frank Caracci about a right-wing talk show host.
I'm your humble steward, your deliverer of hard truths. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses. Bring me your overtaxed, your underlaid, your put down, your fed up. Bring me your rage.
How do you sleep at night?
On a mattress stuffed with cash and the broken dreams of Hillary Clinton.
You suck, McCall!
Hot Air stars Steve Coogan, Taylor Russell, and Nev Campbell. Frank Caracci, the director, and Will Reichel is the screenwriter. Lael.
Yeah, this is, you know, it's a satire, and it's silly, but I actually, for the most part, enjoyed it. I thought Steve Coogan did a terrific job and was absolutely convincing as this kind of Rush Limbaugh character. He is surprised when his niece comes to stay with him, or comes, you know, without any warning. She just sort of shows up at his penthouse doorstep and has to kind of reconcile with the fact that he hasn't talked to her mother, his sister, in I don't know, 30 years, and has very few friends. And so she's sort of like the she forces him to kind of check his life and ask questions about where his values and, you know, his beliefs and so on and so forth. He is sort of this reprehensible character, redeemed only really by Neve Campbell as his girlfriend. It's trite and it's silly, but I thought it was better than I expected it to be.
Hot air.
I thought less of it than you did. He was an interesting character, kind of Jordan Peterson meets Rush Limbaugh. But I felt like he's such a funny and caustic actor that I wanted more from him. I thought the writing was a little bit weak. He's kind of this right-wing talk show host, but he doesn't fully commit to his conservative agenda. He becomes kind of more liberal when it's convenient for the script. And I didn't fully buy it.
But he is a jerk.
He's a total jerk.
He's a bully,
no question.
But
I felt like it was kind of toothless. I mean, you could really go after figures like this. And it could have been a more incisive political satire, and it kind of chose to take a little more kind of gentle redemptive arc.
More of a Green Book kind of.
Don't even go there with me.
it certainly could have had some more teeth to it, but
yeah,
it didn't.
Hot Air is at Lemley's Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills. It's unrated. Adam, a comedy starring Nicholas Alexander, Reese Ernst, the director. Lael, I got about 35 seconds
well,
for your
review.
Well,
that'll be just enough.
Is that enough?
Yes. Adam is an odd coming-of-age film about the trans world, and a young man named Adam is posing as a trans man and falls into a relationship with a lesbian woman and has to convince her that he is, in fact, not a cis man, although he actually is. So it's been a little bit controversial, I guess, in the gay community. I didn't really care for the film terribly much. I thought it really wasn't great.
Adam, the comedy, it's at Lemley's Music Hall, Beverly Hills. It's unrated. Ariel Schrag is the screenwriter, and it's based on her book, Adam, published about 5 years ago. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. Claudia and Lael will continue with me, and we'll bring a couple of additional guests in to talk about the future of art house cinema across the country. It's Film Week. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Well, if you've grown up here in Los Angeles as I have, the Lemley Theaters have just been a part of your life. If you love movies, it's been the place to go see so-called art house cinema, foreign films, independent features. I mean, this is long before, of course, you could stream those types of movies. The Lemley chain has been extremely important, and it's expanded so much over the years as well, most recently with their complex in Glendale. But not just Lemley, but art house cinema generally has been under particular stress this year. And that came to my attention in an LA Daily News piece by Bob Strauss, entertainment news reporter for the Daily News and Southern California News Group. Bob joins us to talk about what's happening in art house films. Bob, good morning.
Good morning, Larry.
So, first of all, let's start with what we know about the financial problems of the Lemley chain. What did you find out?
Well, not too much specifically. At the beginning of this month, reports started surfacing that the chain or some of its theaters might be up for sale. When I came back from vacation at the start of this week, I figured I'd give Greg Lemley, the president of the company, a call and see what he wanted to tell me. And he did not want to tell me very much that he was comfortable with. But he did admit that they weren't denying the reports that they're looking for a buyer. And he just said they're exploring a number of different options.
Well, this, Greg, is the third generation of the Lemley family to operate this. It's been family controlled since the very beginning when his immigrant grandfather and his brother came to the United States with the help of Carl Lemley, founder of Universal Studios. I mean, this chain is part of Hollywood history.
Yeah, very much so. You know, Carl was known as Uncle Carl Lemley. I think it was Ogden Nash who had a poem. Uncle Carl Lemley has a very large family. He brought tons and tons of his relatives and later, you know, refugees from Nazism over from Germany. And Max and Kurt I think, were some of the relatives. They started the Lemley Theater chain in 1938 and then passed it down to Max's son, Bob, and now Greg is the president of
it. And do we know how much of this is related to the state of, you know, movies aimed at adults as opposed to tentpole, you know, comic book character films, and how much is related to Lemley itself with its ambitious expansion?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the expansion's impact has been on this. Obviously, they've spent a lot of money recently. In this decade, they opened the NoHo 7 in North Hollywood, and as you said, last year, Glendale. And they broke ground last year as well on a 7-plex in Newhall. So all of that's a pretty big investment. But I think for the most part, yes, this year has been very bad for what they call specialty films. Now, as you said, that's independent, that's foreign films, experimental films, but also, you know, fairly wide release films that are original and aimed at adult audiences. Films like Booksmart, which, even though, you know, was about teenagers, it had a very adult point of view to it. Late Night this year, they're just not doing well. And I think that's the main reason for a crisis point.
Selling tickets. Just,
we're seeing that.
Yeah, such a huge challenge. Bob Strauss, entertainment news reporter at the LA Daily News, he's the one brought to my attention as a reader that the Lemley Theater's reportedly up for sale after more than 81 years as an independent art house chain, family operated. We invited Greg Lemley to join us. He said he'd be happy to at a future time when he has news to actually report about the future. Presumably that would be if it's sold, if in fact it is putting some of its theaters or the chain up for sale. To talk with us more about the sort of global issue of those types of films Bob was just describing is Paul Dergarabedian, senior media analyst and box office expert at Comscore, the global media measurement and analytics company based here in the Valley. Paul, good to have you with us again.
Great to be here, Larry. Thank you.
Let's quantify what we're talking about. These sorts of films that are aimed at that, you know, middle age above adult audience, art house and the like.
Yeah, a lot of those films have had a tough go, and I look at them in two tiers. There are the small documentaries and foreign films that get a very, very limited release. And then there's films like what Bob talked about was Booksmart, Late Night, films like that, that go into like 2,000 theaters. And then those films really failed to grab an audience. So it's really about those two different aspects. For me, one of the really bright spots in the box office has actually been music documentaries. You know, David Crosby, Remember My Name, Echo in the Canyon, Marianne and Leonard. And then also documentaries like The Biggest Little Farm, Apollo 11, and others. And those films are actually on a per theater basis doing very well. But in terms of overall box office, what those films generate collectively pales by comparison to a Marvel film or a big blockbuster. If you have a chain that's very reliant upon those types of films, but also the wider release films like Booksmart and Late Night, you know, your monthly expenditures remain consistent, just whether the box office is up or down. And right now, year-to-date box office overall in North America is down about 7%, and the summer's relatively flat, slightly below last year.
And in the kinds of movies that the Lemley's show or the Landmark theaters, are those down even more than what you see on the across the board average?
Not necessarily. I think it's more in the realm of those bigger mid-budget films that are aimed at the adult audience, because it seems to me when I'm looking at the per theater averages on some of these documentaries, they're doing very well. And last year, of course, was a watershed year for documentary. And documentary is part of that indie world, a big part of it, generating about $127 million in total box office. And remember, RBG was one of those films, and Won't You Be My Neighbor? And there were these films that just captivated people. When you have documentaries that earn over $20 million each, that's a really rare occurrence. This year, we don't have any quite there, but collectively, they're doing well. So it's interesting, and you know, without the company commenting on why they're doing this, we have to kind of surmise, is it the product? Is it the movies that aren't drawing enough people to generate enough revenue to keep things going? Or is it something else?
Other business issues.
Yeah, other business issues. We just don't know. I will say, though, that Lemley, that name just conjures up Hollywood. Like you said, started Universal Pictures. It is it's woven into the DNA and the fabric of Los Angeles. So yeah. I hope if they do get a buyer that they keep it and keep that name going.
You know, it's just seen we there are no Slumdog Millionaires. There are there are sort of those adult sorts of films.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is maybe close
to that. Exactly. Yeah.
But
yeah.
I keep wondering where streaming services play into all this, because I know even though people went to go see RBG and Won't You Be My Neighbor in theaters, they also, a lot of people wait for it to be on Netflix or on Amazon.
Many times. Right.
Yeah.
You see it there.
Yeah.
That's a great question. And you know what happens a lot? I actually feel that people, it used to be documentaries were like the thing they made us watch in school. And then with films like Super Size Me and Roger and Me, we sort of came into this realm of the very exciting and entertaining documentary. And that continues now.
They weren't medicinal anymore.
They weren't medicinal. You know, the spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. That's what a great documentary does, in my opinion. And music docs have taken on a whole new life. There's just been so many of them. And they're all really pretty darn good. But I think it is a situation where every year rises and falls on the slate. Every and I hate to call movies product, but every single one of these movies is a different entity. And so even if you're on a roll in box office, you can have a slump and then you have an uptick and then you have a downtrend. So
all right.
That's how it goes.
We'll continue with Paul Garabedian, who is senior media analyst, box office expert at ComScore. Paul will continue. Bob Strauss, LA Daily News. And also with us, want to hear what they have to say about it, Claudia Puig, Leo Lowenstein. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Right now, we're talking about the future of so-called art house cinema, both as a genre of film as well as actually going to those physical theaters. Wonderful to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Claudia Puig and Leo Lowenstein, also joining us. Paul Garabedian, who is senior media analyst, box office expert at ComScore, and Bob Strauss, entertainment news reporter for the LA Daily News. Leo, what for you was most concerning about the news that the Lemley Theater chain may be up for sale and that these types of art house films are having a rougher go?
Well, obviously the potential loss of Hollywood history is really troubling, but also what that means for foreign films, international films trying to get an audience, as well as documentaries and other art house indie films. Claudia and I were talking about this yesterday because we were trying to figure out, you know, what went wrong or where did it go? And because some years ago, it seemed that foreign films were kind of making a resurgence, with younger audiences even being more comfortable reading subtitles because of their familiarity with keyboards and texting now. But my kids, my teens, are comfortable consuming their entertainment on a small screen, which isn't necessarily going to lend itself to subtitles. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about the way movies are consumed now.
Yeah, I think that is a big part of it. Though we did a survey called Post Track, and we looked at audiences. And over the past 7 years that we've been doing the survey, the fastest growing and the biggest segment of moviegoers is 18 to 24. And that made me really happy, because there's all this talk that younger people only want the small screen and that going to the movie is like this sweet old fashioned notion, as the song goes, I think. And that's just not true. I think it's about being multi-platform. I listen to vinyl, but I also listen to MP3s. People love going to the movie theater, but they love having content. I feel like the love of content creates more enthusiasm to watch more in more places. That being said, it's fragmented all over the place. So those dollars are being, you know, are chasing, a lot of people, and it's hard to grab an audience and keep it consistent with Disney Plus coming up, other streaming services beefing up their archives, their offerings. It's going to be really interesting to see how people make their way and navigate these waters of big screen, small screen.
Mm. Here in Southern California, you know, another factor that I'm sure makes it very competitive for the art house only chains is ArcLight, because it really straddles both.
Mm. Yeah.
In fact, they even sort of took over the iPic model of the food thing, too. And iPic has filed for bankruptcy.
Mm. Right.
Those are the ones, the lounge chairs where they, you know, offer you food service while you watch the film. So it seems like, as you talk about all these different places, Paul, to, you know, to see movies, it's made it harder for these art house theaters that many of us, you know, started in college to go see movies there, right, to for them to have their place.
Well, we need these chains to carry the torch of the independent film, foreign films, and to see them in the communal environment of the movie theater. I don't ever want to see a world where, you know, of course there's profit and loss and all that and return on investment, but somebody has to take this up and make sure that this doesn't go away. Because seeing any movie in a theater, to me, is the ideal way to see it. And an audience, the electricity that's created when you see a foreign film where you're seeing something that's not the same old rehashed, rebooted, remade thing, but something truly historic in terms of its, you know, the way that they present their ideas on screen in many of the foreign films and in the smaller specialized films. I don't want to see that go away.
Yeah, I was going to raise this point. One of the biggest revelations for me about the Film Week screening series we do at Theater Ace Hotel downtown is a lot of these classic films I saw, like After School, hardly anyone in the theater. It wasn't a big communal experience. Mm-hmm. Now to watch it with, you know, 1,500 people in a movie and the way everybody reacts, it's like kind of like I never saw the film before.
Mm-hmm. It's so
true. Believe the difference.
Well, I just wonder about the content. You talked about sort of the plethora of content, and I feel like, you know, the whole point of art films and indie films was to be a little edgy, a little bit different, a little different from mainstream. And now you have TV that's doing that. Mm-hmm. You know, all these series are doing that.
Great
so,
point.
You know, you stay home and watch Fleabag instead of going to see Booksmart or something.
It's definitely getting harder to draw. You know, there's a bigger buy-in going to the movie theater. You have to get out of your chair, get into your car, of course, if you're in L.A., drive to the movie theater, get your ticket, sit down, and, you know, it's a much bigger buy-in of time and energy. So if you could just kick back on your couch, that's very, you know, plays into our human nature, which is like, oh, I'll just stay in my robe and watch TV all day. But we have to realize there's more to it than that, that you want to see these movies in that communal environment. Like you said, there's nothing like seeing a movie with a lot of other, it's like hearing the Beatles for the first time or watching the moon landing. It's so cool when you get to see a movie with people that maybe you've seen 10 times, but in the movie theater with others becomes a transcendent experience.
The experience is just completely different. Let me bring Bob Strauss, entertainment news reporter of the LA Daily News, back into our conversation. Bob, your thoughts on the effect of all these different options, particularly streaming.
Well, particularly streaming, just from a personal anecdotal point of view, I try to see practically every significant movie I can in a theater. I have for decades. But now that I have Netflix, I like looking at the list of crazy Korean action movies, really wild Spanish horror movies, and staying home and seeing more of those. So I can, you know, I can say that's an effect. But let's think about if we lose Lemily the way it's been for decades, what a loss that would be, because they have always been committed to bringing everything they can to the Los Angeles audience. I looked on their website today. They have 26 different features playing at their 9 venues around Southern California. I think you could look at the ArcLight list. You could look at the Landmark list around here. You don't have anywhere near that variety, that depth of product and availability. And yeah, maybe not that many people are going to them, but think of the cultural loss it would be if that isn't continued here in Los Angeles, of all places.
Yeah, that's tough to think about that happening. Claudia?
I was just thinking, it seems like a habit. Whenever I go to a Lemley, I notice that the audience is largely older.
Right.
And it seems like, you know, the habit that people had when they were in their 20s, these people are now in their 60s or whatever. And so that's the other thing. As people die off, that seems a little scary. You know, the habit of going to see a foreign film in a theater was entrenched that many
decades
ago.
And I think people have become dehabituated to going to movies. And certainly, you know, with my kids' generation, I am really greatly concerned that they're not going to have that sort of quasi-religious experience.
Mm-hmm. I have to say,
movies and
thankfully,
theaters.
My son and his friends do go to the theaters and do go to the Lemley.
So does my daughter. Yeah.
So he does have that experience.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how that common is.
But we did that.
I think it's because of us.
Yeah.
And he grew up so immersed in film. And little niche cinema but most kids don't have that.
But it has to be available. If you don't have the theater, then where are you going to go to see these films? So hopefully other chains will, like ArcLight and others, will carry this on. But I'm not giving up on the whole Lemley model at all. I think there really is a place for it. We never want to see that go away, but there has to be a way for people to get that content in a movie theater.
Yes.
All right.
Fingers crossed. Just think
about all the films. Today's a great example that we reviewed only playing in Lemley theaters and nowhere else. I want to thank joining us today, Paul Dergarabedian, senior media analyst, box office expert at Sherman Oaks-based ComScore. Our thanks to Bob Strauss, LA Daily News entertainment news reporter, and of course, our critics, Leo Lowenstein, Claudia Puig, joining us. Claudia is the president of the LA Film Critics Association. So good to have you with us. We'll, of course, keep you informed on any developments about the future of the Lemley Theater chain. It appears that it is up for sale, and Greg Lemley has promised that he will join us once he has definitive news to report about the future of his three-generation-long-run family film screening company. Have a great weekend from all of us at Film Week.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.